The good guy has a villain's villain in it, a fellow named Krait. He spells his name K-R-A-I-T, like the snake, and that's no mistake either. Krait is a professional hitman. He kills people for money. But he has another aspect of his character that's quite different. He lives in other people's homes. He may live in your home for 3 hours when he needs a place to crash for a little bit, or he may live in your home for a couple of days. He chooses homes where nobody is present, and he can be so clean that no one will ever know that he was there, although sometimes he leaves little remembrances of himself. The scene I'm about to read comes midway in the book, and Krait has just gone onto somebody's front porch and is about to open their door. No lock will stand up to Krait. He can get into any house with no problem. And he's thinking as he unlocks their door. And it begins this way. Krait had no memory of a mother. If he'd ever had one, she must be dead. But he was willing to entertain the notion that, in addition to all the ways he was apart from humanity and superior to it, he might also have come into this world by a route different from the one everyone else had taken. He did not know what his special route might have been, if not a mother. He had not spent any time thinking about it, for he was not, after all, either a biologist or a theologian. As for children, he found them incoherent, incomprehensible, boring, and fundamentally inexplicable. A lot of adults' time went to the care of children, and horrendous amounts in social services was spent on them, in spite of the fact that they were small and weak and ignorant and had nothing to give back to society. Krait had no memories of his childhood. His sincere hope was that he'd never had one, because he was revolted by the thought of a little Krait with head lice and whooping cough, playing in a sandbox with plastic trucks, 3 teeth missing and snot hanging out of his nose. After disengaging both the regular lock set and the deadbolt, he stepped into the house, listened to the emptiness for a moment, and then called out, "Yoo-hoo, anybody home?" He waited for a response, received none, closed the door behind him and turned on a couple of lamps in the living room. The decor was too ornate for his taste and too feminine. His preference for simplicity was so strong that he might have been happy as a monk in a particularly Spartan monastery, except that monks were not permitted to murder people. Before fully committing himself to this residence, Krait toward the living room, wiping his fingers along the tops of door frames and over the higher surfaces of tall furniture, pleased to discover that these surfaces were as clean as those that could be easily seen. When he examined the sofa cushions and the armchair upholstery for evidence of discolorations from hair oil and sweat, he found none. He didn't discover a single food or beverage stain. With his penlight, he looked under a sofa and under a sideboard. No dust bunnies. Satisfied that the homeowners met his standards of cleanliness, Krait relaxed on the sofa. He propped his feet on the coffee table. After sending a coded text message that succinctly explained his situation, he requested new transportation, significant new weaponry, and a modest number of high-tech devices that might be useful now that his assignment had become more complex. He provided the address at which he was currently taking refuge and asked to be given an estimated delivery time when one could be calculated. Then he stripped down to his underwear and carried his clothes into the kitchen. In the laundry room, Krait located spare hangers for his pants, shirt, and sports coat. He hung these clothes from handles on the kitchen cabinetry. Attired only in underwear, socks, and shoes, he closed the blinds at the kitchen windows. He did not approve of people who made spectacles of themselves. He found a clothes brush with stiff bristles and another with soft bristles. The discovery of a clothes sponge delighted him. The homeowners seemed to be as fastidious about the condition of their garments as they were about their house cleaning. Before departing, he would be tempted to leave them a note of approval, but also some advice. Currently on the market were non-toxic, biodegradable dry cleaning fluids for home use, of which they had none. He felt certain that they would be pleased with the products he recommended. Using the lightly dampened sponge only where necessary, and then each brush as nature and the condition of the different fabrics required, he had soon completed refreshing the garments. Because the laundry room was small, he set up the ironing board in the kitchen. The homeowners possessed a high-quality, versatile steam iron. He had once employed the same brand of steam iron to torture a young man before killing him. Unfortunately, the superb appliance had been ruined by the end of the session. When he had finished pressing his clothes, he went in search of black shoe polish, a suitable brush, and a buffing cloth. He found a shoeshine kit under the kitchen sink. After returning everything he had used to its proper place, he dressed and went upstairs in search of a full-length mirror. He found one in the bathroom. His appearance pleased him. He might have been a schoolteacher or a salesman or anyone at all. Mirrors intrigued him. Everything was reversed in a mirror, which suggested to him some mysterious truth about life that he had not yet been able to grasp. He'd once read an interview with a woman writer who said that the fictional character with whom she most intensely identified was Lewis Carroll's young Alice. She claimed that in spirit she was Alice. Because she had many lamentable opinions, Crichton visited the writer one evening. She proved to be quite petite. He easily picked her up and threw her at a full-length mirror to see if she would magically pass through and vanish into Wonderland. In fact, she was not Alice. The mirror shattered. When she failed to pass through the mirror, he spent some time passing fragments of the mirror through her. Only when his phone vibrated did Crichton become aware that he had been standing in front of this particular looking glass for more than a minute or two. A text message informed him that the order he had placed would be delivered by 2 a.m. According to his wristwatch, he had 1 hour and 55 minutes to wait. Impatience did not trouble him. He viewed this as an opportunity to visit with the family, who unknowingly had provided his refuge. He began by looking through the cabinets in the master bathroom. There he learned, to his satisfaction, that he shared a number of brand preferences with these people. Toothpaste, antacids, a headache remedy. Each time he encountered a brand choice that he believed to be misguided, he dropped the item in a nearby wastebasket. In two dresser drawers in the master bedroom, Crichton found a collection of sexy lingerie. With interest, he unfolded each item, examined it, and then refolded it. He did not disapprove of this discovery. If the average person was entitled to anything, it was the unrestrained expression of his or her sexuality. If you'd like to know more about what Crichton does in These People Home and in some others during the book, why don't you get a copy of The Good Guy?